Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, and we have our panel of science. Can two people be a panel? You can be a panel, right?
We're a hemi panel.
Yeah.
A hemi panel. We have two scientists here. We're down one. But I think we have some credible people here in the studio to answer your questions. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you could go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/WAMC radio. You'll see a Vox Pop post there. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. You can tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. You can post your questions and comments at our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. There's a place to post your questions and comments there. Or call us. That's good, too. 1-800-348-2551. With all that said, let's meet our scientists.
Helen Girardella, Department of Biology, the University at Albany.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and retired.
Well, okay. The gauntlet has been thrown. You both are going to have to do one-third extra duty today. Yeah. Can you do it?
Someone get one-third more pay.
Oh, yes. Well, it's definitely worth the money here on the Science Forum. Well, nice to have you both here. And what's new in the world of biology, Helen?
What is not new in the world biology? It's blowing out all over the place, as a matter of fact. But this is not my field, but one thing that...
Oh, you're not biology? Yeah, you're biology.
This is not my subfield, but one thing that's fascinating me lately is they keep pushing back the age at which human beings started to act like human beings, like cave paintings and all like that. Apparently, we have been traveling all over the world by boat early on, and there's some question about whether the New World might have been... settled not only by people coming across through the Bering Land Bridge, but actually coming from Europe by way of boat.
Program on that.
Okay, well then you know more about it than I do. But this blows my mind. And recently, I forgot where it was, but in Southeast Asia, if I remember correctly, essentially cave paintings. But they seem to predate or at least be as old as the European ones.
So... How far back have they pushed our basic intellectual capacity to have been more or less of the modern variety?
I don't know how you know. If somebody's able to draw one of the local animals or draw a print of his or her hand, what does that tell you? And apparently that goes way back.
Yeah, that's what, back about 40,000 years.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, and probably the capacity was developed before that.
Yeah.
Because it spread as modern humans spread.
So is there the chance that there were civilizations long gone that we have no, fairly advanced civilizations that there are no records of and no evidence for?
Well, define civilization, because as we get going, or as we went back, again, in a different field, I've just read something that was commenting that the average single human being can handle about 150 contacts, and that if it gets much larger than that, now that's the ancestral village. Mm. If it gets much larger than that, you have to start building another tier, as in leaders, elected or not elected officials, people who are running things, and there's a limit to that size, and so we start stacking layers of bureaucracy. But it's very hard to know.
Mm.
But yeah, it's just burgeoning.
Yeah, and in general, you didn't develop cities, concentrations of people, before there was at least some sort of agriculture.
Right.
Even in the New World civilizations, it was hard to sustain just by hunting and gathering. So the onset of agriculture is pretty well established.
What, about 8,000 BC?
Something like that. So it'd be hard to have anything that resembles a city before that.
All right, here's a little snide email we have here from Steve, who says, is it actually possible to be blinded by science, or is that a myth?
We do it every day.
Explain.
Some of these discoveries, which may or may not be accurate, are really pretty spectacular. And it's possible to get kind of a fan club going, and we've all done this, and lose your sense of objectivity, and then at some point you realize, well, this isn't quite that simple, and then we start all over again.
Yeah, an example of that, I mean, there's been all of the hoo-ha about the discovery of the polarization in the microwave background, you know, data that came from the telescopes in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And that made quite a splash. And over time, it required a lot of corrections to the data to filter out a lot of noise in order to get the signal. And they had to make some estimates on dust in the Milky Way galaxy, which kind of masked the signal. And apparently they didn't get that quite right. So a lot of the signal has disappeared. It turns out, I mean, not to zero, but perhaps less sure than before. And that happens a lot in science, where there's an initial discovery that looks really good, and then some questions about it. And right now is sort of a critical time. It may be that finding will just slip through their fingers and drift away to nothingness, or there'll be confirmation and it will become more robust.
A friend of mine who passed away recently, but who was a phenomenal scientist, said he would rather be interesting than right, because if he was interesting, people would continue to think about it and research it, and if it really looked right, and it wasn't, it would still stop there. They wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. John in Pine Bush. John.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to bring up something that happened about 2 weeks ago. There was a peer-reviewed paper published dealing with a subject called LENOR, which stands for low-energy nuclear reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with what used to be called cold fusion, and which is the production of an anomalous heat given the right types of metals and an electrical input or heat input. And a company in Italy for the past 5 years is trying to commercialize that effect, because they're able to stabilize that anomalous heat effect, wherein this past experiment that was published, they were able to, for 32 days straight, produce anomalous heat with a very small amount of nickel and lithium as being the fuel source, with hydrogen added. And it's a tremendous breakthrough. It would be able to allow the commercialization of this cold fusion. I attended a lecture on Monday. It was given at SUNY Orange with a person talking about this technology. He was a scientist from Iowa. Gave a presentation of all the people that are involved in it. I didn't know if your panel is at all aware of it.
Well, cold fusion has been on sort of the periphery of discussion for many, many years now, but this is something new. Jim, do you have any knowledge of this?
I've read a little bit about this sort of thing. To my mind, this is an example of, where there are initial reports of something remarkable. Usually a relatively small effect, and then with assurance that this is going to be optimized and improved and become something big. And usually it just slips through their fingers. It's really hard to do these experiments well.
But peer review doesn't necessarily mean it has cut the mustard.
Peer review means the editor has sent it to somebody like Helen or me.
And, I just reviewed one.
Yeah, me too. And the peers do different quality of job. And, I mean, there's a lot of nonsense that still makes it past peer review and into the literature. Now, in the really high-rank journals, peer review is extremely rigorous. In the lower prestige journals, peer review can be pretty cursory.
John, I know you have emailed me on this within the last couple of weeks, and I actually didn't see the materials that you sent the other day. Alas, we do not have a physicist today. I'm sure Ivor would have been happy to discuss this with you, but maybe on the next show?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I sent your producer a one-page description with links to the research and the papers. If you could pass that on to your panel and to anyone that's interested.
Will do. Hey, we'll do.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Number to call here on the Science Forum is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. So blinded by science, peer review sometimes is blinded as well.
Yeah. I mean, I can simply say that in the journals that I read in my field, which is applied science, so it's not, you know, we're not talking science and nature magazines here. There's just a lot of stuff that's utter nonsense.
So doesn't that affect the peer who reviews it ultimately if you review something that turns out to be nonsense and say, oh, yeah, this is okay?
Yeah, I would think so.
All right, let's take a break here. Mr. Zach, 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. More on the way.
Support for WAMC comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Winslow Homer, The Nature and Rhythm of Life, through January 4th, 2015, arkellmuseum.org. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more, paradisecopies.com. And Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School, Harlemville, New York. Early childhood through grade 12. High school open house November 1st from 10 to 2. Nurturing Living Connections, hawthornevalleyschool.org.
Yeah, it's the Science Forum, all right. 1-800-348-2551. We had a call. John down at the Culinary Institute wanted us to know that, you know, beer is the reason civilization happened.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't argue.
And I would think that that's the reason civilization continues, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely.
Go for a beer right now. Abraham in Enfield, Connecticut, you're on.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about these climate models. Computer theoretical models for making predictions about the climate. Now, I've been reading or hearing that, say, between 1980 and 2000, the models predicted the temperature should increase, and the actual measurements showed that the average temperature of the Earth was increasing. But say between 2000 and 2014. The model predicted that the temperature should increase, but the measurements showed that the average temperature of the Earth had remained more or less constant during that time. So my question is, what is the significance of this? Are there processes that the scientists don't understand about the climate?
You mean the model being wrong?
Yes, the model being wrong.
Right.
And What about the predictions using the model now? Are they still valid?
The warming has gone on apace. Now, what's confused a lot of people is that we're trying to make sense out of very noisy data. From year to year, temperatures go up, temperatures go down a little bit. And their tendency is now to amongst the deniers, to benchmark things back to a spike that was, what, about 10, 15 years ago. That was one year that was extraordinarily warm. On average, it's still, the temperature has been increasing, but got to remember that what they're measuring here is atmospheric temperature. That's what the discussion is about. And that's only a small part of the global warming. Most of the heat goes into the oceans. And where the heat's been going in the last decade or so is into the deep ocean. And you can tell that because, among other measurements, sea level has been increasing nice and steadily due to thermal expansion of the seawater. So the warming has continued. The data are noisy for the air temperatures, but it has not disagreed substantially from what's being expected.
It's not my field, but I'm going to try to add something here. We're dealing with several interlocking processes, and sometimes if one of them warms, it may actually have an effect of temporarily shutting off something else or diverting a stream or a current or a flow of heat. And so wherever you're measuring it looks like it's cooler, but overall the whole system does seem to be going towards warming as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and as long... And to my mind, again, I'm not an expert in this field either, but the oceans provide this huge thermometer. And as long as sea level is rising, something must be getting warmer.
Something is getting warmer.
And there's just very little way to wiggle around that.
So the models themselves are always in a state of being upgraded?
Sure. And you know, again,
the
deniers will wave their hand and say it's just a model. But... all of engineering and almost all of science relies on models of one kind or another. That, in fact, is what the scientists and engineers try to do, is to get good mathematical models of some kind of system. So to denigrate it as being only a model is really disingenuous. That's all of science and engineering involve models.
There's an old saying, you cannot do only one thing. In other words, anything we do is going to have repercussions, and they may not necessarily go in a direction that is predictable.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Joan in Massachusetts. Hiya, Joan, you're on.
Oh, thanks. I was wondering if, because of, you consider the problems of rising sea level and, you know, the horrible droughts, is it possible or practicable to desalinate the seawater and help remedy the effects of drought?
It's expensive, isn't it?
Yeah. There are ways to do it inexpensively enough for drinking water. To do it in large enough quantities for irrigation is pretty expensive. The best way to do it is probably reverse osmosis, and there's been progress in the membranes that are used to do that, but it still takes quite a bit of energy.
Explain to us just simply, so we can all understand, what reverse osmosis entails.
You can think of it as filtering out the salt ions.
Like a coffee filter?
In a way, with little teeny tiny pores. I mean, that's not, you're pushing it through a membrane. And it takes pressure to do that,
mm-hmm.
of course.
So energy is required to do that.
Yes. You got to put energy into an electric motor to pump it to get the pressure that you need to get it through, and then you're left with water with less salt in it that's gone through the membrane, and then water with more salt in it that hasn't, and you got to do something with that.
Can you get it to the point where the salt has completely separated?
The more you try to separate, the more pressure it's going to take to do that. So there's some optimum on the amount of energy that is cost that you're willing to put into the system and the purity of the water that you want to get out.
Joan, thank you for the call.
Oh, thank you for your answer.
1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. I've heard, at least anecdotally, that some Persian Gulf states where there's not a lot of water will, in fact, do fairly large-scale desalinization.
Yes, there are very large-scale desalination plants. There are a number of companies, my former employer, GE, and very large water business that included desalination.
Is there any other way besides forcing it through a membrane that this could be done, any experimental way?
Yeah, there are evaporative ways that it can be done in which...
So like an alcohol still?
Yeah, where the water can be heated up and evaporated and then condensed on another surface.
But efficiency-wise, that's not a good way to go? It seems like you could get rid of all the salt by doing that.
Yeah, it's less efficient. The trick in designing that kind of system is recovering the heat that's given off during condensation in the condenser part of the still. You need to recover that heat in the water that's going into where it's going to boil. So it all comes down to the efficiency of those heat exchangers in doing that. And I, again, not an expert in this area, but apparently the energy balance comes out where, in general, it seems to be more efficient to do it with reverse osmosis.
Okay. Number to call here on the Science Forum is 1-800-348-2551. Helen Giardella and Jim Pickett, they're the whole panel today. So have at it with your questions, everyone. Edward in Lake Katrine. Edward.
Hi. About 20 years ago, I read a book. I think it was called The Hot Zone. It was about Ebola. And I understand that the author of that book is coming out with a re-release, and he's changing some of the things he had written in his original book. But one of the things he said in an interview recently was that it's known that Ebola isn't airborne anymore, but it can mutate quite easily. And he suggested it could go to something we'll not be able to stop from spreading. I'm wondering how we keep track of that. There is apparently a way of keeping track of that, how it mutates. But how hopeful are scientists about being able to keep this under control?
Helen.
I don't have an answer. I think everybody is very, very seriously worried about it because a lot of these viruses are perfectly capable of mutating, and as long as it is only spread by contact, which is the current thought, there is some possibility of restraining the spread. But if it does become airborne, it could obviously could be very, very serious. And Jim, do you have any?
From my reading on this, it would take quite a bit of mutation to put it into an airborne form. We're not standing on the edge of the precipice on that one.
Okay.
Another thing I'm wondering about the wisdom of is, you know, they are limiting the amount of airports in this country where they will accept people flying in from countries that are affected by this.
But yes.
How much sense does it make to spread those airports around the country? Why don't they just focus on one part of the country and keep them all there?
Well, I think, again, there are so many things involved when you consider the transportation system, the need to move people, the need to move things from one location to another. To make that kind of a change would seriously disrupt a lot of our systems that are functional and that we depend on to get everything that we need for daily living and corporate production and so forth. So it's a trade-off. It's like, again, this business of controlling salinity that we just talked about. Whatever we do is going to be very expensive.
All right. Edward, thank you for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number on the Science Forum. So, Helen, clear it up for me about what a virus actually is. Is a virus a living thing, and how does it replicate?
Let's see. Now, what day is this? Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we say. Originally, they were not at all living. They weren't considered alive, and to some extent, they still are not considered alive, because the first ones that were studied consisted of a so-called nucleic acid, and that would be DNA, which is our genetic material, or RNA, and a protein coat. And the protein coat would enable the virus to stick onto a cell to find a potential host. Excuse me. And then the nucleic acid would get in, take over the genetic machinery of the host, and start making virus instead of more host materials. But as somebody pointed out, if they're going to be infectious, there had to be things there originally to infect, like cells must have preceded viruses. And some of them in the not too distant past have been found to be fairly large.
And, how large?
the size of a small cell in some cases are approaching that. And they not only have DNA or RNA, the nucleic acid, and the protein coat, but they also have some of the machinery that our cells use to make new proteins and to basically do their daily living. So the jury is out on exactly what they are. We don't classify them as alive, but they are a lot more sophisticated, and some of them can do a lot more things than we used to think they were.
How do they reproduce?
Well, I want to make one more statement.
Please,
about
go ahead.
We tend to want to put things into nice, crisp categories,
right,
that a virus is living or not, that Pluto is a planet or not, various things where they, you know, you say it either is or it isn't. But the world, in fact, is all these shades of gray. The world is what the world is, regardless of how we want to classify it. And if you look at the way people talk about viruses, there are vaccines that involve killed viruses. That's a term that's used. Well, you can't kill it if it's not alive. So in biology class, there'll be definitions of living that include that it has to have a metabolism of some kind. Okay, that's a way to define it. And in that case, the viruses don't have metabolism, and so,
well, actually, some of them are borderline. So
yeah, borderline.
Right.
But others clearly do not. At the same time, they can reproduce and have functions in one form, and then you can disrupt it, that is, kill it, and it doesn't do that anymore. Well, that's sort of alive. So this question about whether it's alive or not,
right,
in these gray areas. I mean, there are questions, and there are situations in which it's clear a rock is not alive, you know. And
well,
as far as you know,
that's this year's.
Yeah, but whether a virus is alive or not fits into that nice gray area.
It would seem to me that would be an important question. Could a virus, if it is not alive, just hang around for 3,000 years under some soil and?
Oh yeah,
sure,
yeah. It's just, they're just, well, actually.
So can bacteria.
Yeah.
When they go into.
Which is alive.
Some of them.
Yeah. A bacterium is indisputably alive.
Okay.
It's defined as alive. Because it can do all of its own processing. Now, the some of them are parasitic, but they make their own proteins and blah, blah, blah. They don't. Viruses, most of them do not, but.
Yeah. And. So it becomes very ambiguous.
We'll go back to the phones in a moment at 1-800-348-2551. So, Jim, they're not alive, but they reproduce. How does a virus reproduce? And then we'll get back to the phones.
Helen can probably correct me, but in one way or another, it gets its genetic material into a cell, takes over the function of the cell.
Takes over the machinery.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like I get my control system into a factory, but I take over their hardware, and now I'm using their hardware to make more of my stuff instead of.
Yeah, and it forces the cell to make more of the virus.
And the cell basically stops, if it's a, let's say, a gut cell, it stops making more gut material and it starts making viruses, and then eventually it makes more of the virus nucleic acid and the virus proteins. Eventually they find each other and wrap them, you know, assemble. Cell ruptures, and we have, you know, 40,000 viruses that can now go and infect other cells.
So it will eventually, ultimately, kill the host?
Well, not necessarily.
No. Well, no. If the host is a cell.
Well, yeah, it'll kill the host cell. Well, usually.
Well,
if it bursts the cell.
There's some estimate that, I don't know, I've heard as high as 50% of our genome, our DNA, may have been viral in origin.
But see, it's also to the evolutionary advantage of a virus not to kill too many of the organisms that it infects. Because, like with the Ebola is clearly a new sort of thing because it's so deadly. What a successful virus wants to do is infect the organism, leave the organism in the infectious state for a long time so it can spread itself around.
Mm.
And yeah, that's why cold viruses are so successful.
Isn't there some intelligence involved?
Don't go there.
No.
Rumors are that HIV is beginning to lose its virulence in some of the regions where it hasn't really been successfully treated because those people who were susceptible did pass away, and it's now coming to some kind of accommodation with the host. And it's in the virus's interest, as Jim just said, to basically not wreck everything, because it's wrecking future homes for its descendants. So
it's fascinating, because it seems like that is almost an intelligent design. In other words, to continue, it has to change where it's not killing the host.
Well,
imagine you have a case, though, that the virus infects and it kills the host instantly. Okay. Now, the host hasn't had a chance to make very many replicates of the virus. It also hasn't had a chance to infect a lot of other hosts. So that's not a very successful strategy. And the virus that is equipped to do that won't reproduce very much and will die out.
And in fact, I wish human societies could be a little more accommodating.
I like it. All right, let's take a break. Zach, 1-800-348-2551. Yeah, it's the simple life here. We're talking about viruses on the Science Forum.
Support for WAMC comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. Maria College, Albany, hosting an open house this Saturday at 11 a.m. with information about 2- and 4-year degrees in psychology, nursing, occupational therapy, management, paralegal, liberal arts, and more. MariaCollege.edu. The Adirondack Council, over 30 years of advocacy on behalf of New York's Wilderness Park, working to protect rare wildlife and its habitat, AdirondackCouncil.org. And Field Goods, delivering fresh produce from local farms for pickups at workplaces or community sites from Saratoga to Yonkers, field-goods.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Let's go to Carl in Palatine. Carl, you're on.
Hello, thank you. Excellent program. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
A couple of very quick, short ones, if I can. Having written to WAMC with this question, the CDC director, Tom Friedkin, I believe his name is, adamantly assured us for weeks prior to these nurses getting ill, nurses who treated the fellow from Liberia in Dallas, Ebola virus can only be transmitted via bodily fluids. So I asked the question, bodily fluid, phlegm, transmitted on a crowded New York City subway via sneezing. How can there be assurance that this does not occur?
That I don't know. I don't know whether the Ebola virus gets into the respiratory tract.
Whether they mean blood, in other words, something that's normally not in contact with the outside world.
Yeah, blood, sweat,
et cetera.
Yeah.
If this fellow, the Tom Friedkin, absolutely adamantly insisted for weeks that only transmitted via bodily fluids, then what in the world is he talking about? How do people other through the HIV-type problem transmit bodily fluids if not through something as simple as a sneeze? And then, for that matter, which we have been told about, people who have suffered and died from Ebola, their bodies have to be treated somehow, placed somewhere, cremated or something.
Yeah.
And those are hands-on operations.
Well, my sympathies are with you in the sense that anytime anybody says always or never, that can change overnight because, again, these viruses are mutating very, very rapidly, or they can.
Well, Carl, thank you very much for the call. It is the Science Forum on WAMC. Let's go to Marta in Poughkeepsie. Marta.
Hi there, Ray.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question's related to smart meters, and I wonder if the panel has heard of them. about the health consequences related to having them near you. They're for electric, gas, and water. And they're a new way to meter those kinds of sources.
Yeah.
And they give off radio frequency radiation, low pulses every few seconds around the clock. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if the panel's heard about that and what their opinion might be.
I haven't, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, there's one of those meters in my house.
Yeah.
There's a gazillion things giving off radio frequency pulses all the time. There is no mechanism by which radio frequency pulses can have biological effects at the intensity at which these are. There's never been any credible, reproducible evidence showing that.
So you're saying then at that frequency and at that power level,
yeah,
it does not
interact with the materials in living things.
Well, that's not the experience a lot of people are having. They're talking like dizziness, depression, disorientation, strokes, heart palpitations, DNA disruption of every cell. That's the kind of stuff I'm hearing.
No, look, those kinds of things can be caused by anything, most likely emotional states. There is no physical way in which radio frequency...
Light
is radiation, where radio frequency, electromagnetic radiation, can interact with the stuff in your body in any way to do any kind of changes.
Well, I think you may be mistaken, and I wish you would take a look at Take Back Your Power, Investigating the Smart Grid,
right,
which is a documentary about it, and I think that you might find some interesting information there you haven't heard yet.
Marta, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Now, of course, when you study to be a ham radio operator or an engineer, you learn that at certain frequencies and at certain duty cycles, your tissue can be heated up by radio frequency.
Yes.
But not. It takes some power. In other words, on 10 meters, the power might be, you might be limited to 1,000 watts.
Sure.
And you don't. Nowadays, when you're licensed, you have to prove that your station is within compliance and the radiation is not in a place where people can be subjected to it all the time at certain frequencies.
Yep.
But these are not high power units.
No, they're very low power. There's just no physical mechanism by which they can affect biological stuff.
And as I was listening, I was thinking about all the other potential causes besides just stress. Pollutants, which could have effects that
I remember it was 30 years ago now, there was all of the hoo-ha over power lines.
Right.
And that was an example of where whatever effects were being seen slipped through the fingers. Upon further examination, things aren't reproducible. The effects just kind of go away when they're looked at in more detail.
Have they continued to do longitudinal studies about that?
Don't know. But it had all of the hallmarks of things which look like they're true for a while, and then it just tails off. Where then you get this long period of time where there's kind of a little bit of noise, where every once in a while things will pop up there's a study showing that the smart grids cause problems, but then that will go away too.
What about cell phones? We hear a lot from Europe and otherwise, and every now and then you'll hear a study that says, hey, this is not good. And going around with a cell phone to your head all day long for long periods of time is not good. Others in the industry say, well, you know, the science is very flawed on this.
There again, what is the without a mechanism by which you go from the radio frequency, electromagnetic radiation, to something happening.
Well, heating tissue. Radio frequency will heat tissue. Microwave ovens heat things.
Let's say that you heat that region by a tenth of a degree. What's that going to do?
Presumably, the circulatory system should be able to handle it. We do this all the time.
Not saying one way or the other. I'm just saying there have been those studies that you see every now and again, and agreed, they tend to disappear.
Yeah.
That indicate this. All right, here's a quick question, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from our buddy George up in Saratoga. What can be done to increase scientific literacy in the United States? Thanks, George.
Oh, my goodness.
You have 12 seconds to answer that.
I would like to see, starting in the elementary schools, where the kids do real experiments. I've always been a fan of the planting seeds experiment.
Yeah.
In which you can have a hypothesis. Does planting the seed upside down mean that the plant will grow down into the dirt? You ask that to a little kid, and you get their attention right away. And you can do an experiment, and you can find out. And that's what science really is all about. But science gets taught as this litany of facts that come down from on high by these peer-reviewed scientists. and it escapes many people. So I think if it's taught as an experimental thing from the very beginning, that it would capture people's imagination more.
Ellen?
And my answer would be getting them outside at night, getting them seeing the night sky, which is not always possible depending on where you live. But some personal connection with the physical world that hasn't been affected by human activity.
For most of us, is it possible that now technology has advanced to a point, a magical point, where we just assume we'll just get a gadget to do whatever we need and there's really no need to even wonder why?
Well, my take on that is usually very, again, simplistic and definite. Most of the stuff that you find on these, or that we find on these, have been put there by somebody else. And it's when a little kid discovers something that nobody in the family has seen, or possibly nobody has seen, that's, for me, when the education really begins.
All right, let's go to Lynn in Pittsfield. Lynn, thanks for waiting. You're on.
No problem. It seems to me that a lot of the research going on with Ebola could relate into HIV research as well. I remember going back many years ago that I've heard people tell me that, you know, HIV was child's play next to Ebola. Do you think that with the research and the genetic mutations and how to stop them could result in a vaccine for HIV by studying Ebola?
I don't know enough about it to answer very precisely, but obviously anything we learn about how to develop vaccines, and in particular how to develop them quickly, because I think this is one of the issues right now, is going to help just in general, but I don't know specifically.
I think in my reading that the Ebola virus and developing vaccines for it is, from what I read, a pretty straightforward thing.
Okay.
That it's a matter of the time and the resources to go in and do it.
Whereas, yeah, because they really haven't done that. They really haven't studied Ebola as much as they have.
Right. But, yeah, and from what I've read, that it's pretty straightforward, whereas HIV is anything but.
And I know it's genetically mutated from what it was originally from the original virus and strain, and my understanding was that Ebola also is genetically mutating as well. And I was wondering if something could break that RNA and DNA, would it benefit, I would assume, our study in HIV as well, I guess. Well,
Lynn, I'm sorry.
Well, all viruses mutate.
I was going to say, Lynn has actually brought up a point, and that is, to the extent that we are studying viruses and understanding them, anything we do is hopefully going to, but we tend to wait until we're confronted with a disaster, and then we fire up the engine.
Especially one that hits close to home. And
I think that's a point.
Yeah. Lynn, thanks a lot. Let's go to Sharon in Saratoga. Sharon, you're on.
Hi, everyone. My question has to do with viruses, but I guess basically when you have the viruses that live in your body forever, I guess, like chicken pox, herpes, Lyme disease, so you had all of those as an individual, what repercussions would it have on you as you age? Like, does your immune system wear out, or do they all just take over all of a sudden and you're just toast?
Well, the immune system certainly doesn't do what it used to do. There's no question about that. But chicken pox and shingles. I don't know how much of that is promotional and how much of it is real, but...
What do you mean?
Well, apparently, there are all these ads. If you've had chicken pox, do you have the shingles?
Yeah, I saw that
the
other day.
Well, viruses can lay dormant and can wake up later on, but whether this is... How we could control this, I guess, maybe is something that...
Yeah, I don't think it's well understood what causes them to break out of the dormant state.
Right.
Sharon,
again, they're just molecules.
Go ahead,
Sorry,
Sharon.
What was that last part?
They're just molecules in the simplest form.
So are we all.
Viruses in general?
Well, in the simplest form, they are just a couple of sets of molecules put together. Now, we're a little more complex, Jim.
Yeah.
At least we like to think that.
Article in, I don't know, you know, it was on the internet, but it seemed like a reliable website saying that someone had found that they believe that the virus was leading to Alzheimer's.
Herpes, you said?
Do you know anything about that?
You said herpes was leading to Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
Anybody?
Want to take a shot at that?
I haven't heard that.
That's an interesting one. Sharon, thanks a lot for the call. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Our friend Bonnie wrote in, please debunk chemtrails.
Oh.
Anybody want to take a shot?
Chemtrails are water.
Okay. Let's go on over to Jeff in Gardner, New York. Jeff, you're on.
Yes. Well, thanks for the show. I remember that a couple of years ago, my cousin and I were arguing about an article about this electromagnetic radiation affecting a man who was carrying a cell phone in his pants pocket. Now, I think the article was trying to profess that it would cut down both the number of sperm and also the efficacy of the sperm. And my cousin pointed out that the article that it was based on, or the scientific study that it was based on, was performed in vivo instead of in vitro, I guess in a petri dish instead of inside your body. But it seems to me either one would indicate that the electromagnetic radiation could affect these living cells.
It's really, really hard to know something for sure. Doing experiments and getting good results is hard. And if somebody's doing a one-off experiment or a few experiments or things aren't controlled exactly right, you can get most any result that you want. So until that sort of thing is reproduced, that a mechanism is found for why this is happening, it's not something to take very seriously.
Now, okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Jim?
Yeah, I mean, there are other things. Obviously, if you warm your private parts too much,
fine,
you are going to adversely affect the sperm.
Okay.
But it's a matter of degree.
Okay, fair enough.
And if it's a pun?
Yes.
Okay.
And if it's a tenth of a degree, it's not going to do anything because your body can regulate it better than that.
All right. Well, we've sorted that out. We have about a minute left. Nina in East Hoosick, you only have about 30 seconds to pose the question, okay?
Right. So I called on another show about electrical impulses that I had seen at completely regular intervals at a tree level and had that explained as what was called will-o'-the-wisp. This is a different but similar phenomenon. I wondered if you had an answer for this. There's no sweeping spotlight in the sky, nothing man-made that's creating this. But again, it's a sweeping phenomenon at completely regular intervals in the sky. Am I seeing some form of lightning, or what am I seeing?
Okay, we only have about 20 seconds. I'm so sorry, Nina. This might be a tough one to get in very quickly here.
Yeah, if it's that regular, I would think that it's an artificial light source
of some kind.
Yeah, I'm
thinking airport signaling or something like that.
Yeah, okay, thanks a lot. Nina, I apologize. We are out of time. Well, that was fun, Helen. That was good.
It certainly was.
Maybe we'll just have Helen and Jim on more often, and we'll cut out the other scientists.
Yeah,
we also need the same quality questioners.
Well, there you go. There you go. Well, thanks, everybody, and we appreciate the 2 out of 3 who showed up today. That was nice, and thank you for calling at home and listening. Support comes from Curran Compliance Services, hosting a national symposium on life insurance compliance November 12th through 14th in Saratoga Springs, featuring keynote speaker Cynthia Cooper, whistleblower at WorldCom, currancompliance.com. Hubbard Hall Center for the Arts and Education, Cambridge, New York, presenting the musical The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, weekends November 7th through November 30th, hubbardhall.org. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, presenting a concert season of various genres, including jazz, zydeco, funk, classical, and chamber music at the Massey Center for the Arts, strose.edu/concerts. Thank you once again for listening. Thanks to Helen and Jim. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Colleen O'Connell answered your calls. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, the first one since the fun drive, it's Birds with Rich Guthrie.